This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava.
And I'm Kathleen Harris.
And welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income on the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, if you're listening to this program, I bet you're paying more for groceries, gas, and housing now than you were a year ago. And chances are good that next year you'll be paying more than you are now. Expenses just seem to keep going up. I mean, think about it. Have you ever looked at your checkbook from 10 years ago? What you used to pay for gasoline? You remember when we used to get gas for a little over a dollar a gallon? Or what are you paying for a pound of hamburger? What are your tuition costs? What are you paying for medical insurance? Or for that matter, your utility bill. Just the average day-to-day cost of living has gone up almost every single year for most Americans. And yet, incomes aren't following in the same pattern. If you look at some of the statistics, a lot of Americans are falling further and further behind as their cost of living goes up and their wages or their incomes aren't keeping up with the level of cost of living.
Well, you know, Jim, I doubt that there are all that many of us that have had the guts or are able to approach our supervisor or boss and say, hey, you know, my cost of living's going up. I think you need to give me a raise. You know, I just think that most employees just don't have that kind of situation going on at their work. So it's very rare that your income really keeps up with inflation. Just wage increases just don't seem to work that way.
And it's not just people that are working, Kathleen. I mean, if you're retired, you may be in a similar situation. I mean, think about your Social Security. It's indexed to inflation, but I bet you don't control how that inflation number is calculated. So you have no control on how much your Social Security paycheck increases year over year. And many retirement income investments that are available to you don't take inflation into account either. So today, Kathleen and I are going to discuss an investment that may be more likely to keep pace with inflation than other alternatives. We're going to be talking about dividend-paying stocks.
Yep, that's right, folks. One more time, we're going to talk about dividend-paying stocks. You know, Jim's had a couple of discussions with Dr. Wade Fowle, professor of retirement income at the American College, about the value of dividend-paying stocks and planning for a retirement income to last for the remainder of your lifetime. You know, later on in the program, Jim's going to be having a discussion with Dr. Michael Finca, professor and director of retirement planning and living at Texas Tech. They're going to talk about retirement income sources and drawdown of funds, as well as something else I think a lot of people don't realize it involves a little bit of advanced planning as well when you head into retirement, which is the happiness and satisfaction you find in your retirement years. Again, surprisingly enough, this can require a little bit of advanced thinking on your part.
You know what's amazing, Kathleen, is that the baby boomers represent probably the largest retirement population in this country's history. And I know that, gosh, when I began my career back in 1980, I got my CFP and became a certified financial planner. Back then, financial planning was sort of a new field of finance. We weren't thinking about that. Now it's become commonplace. What I find amazing now is a lot more colleges today in their finance department are coming up with a whole new department on retirement planning. It's more complex today. The laws, the taxation, estate planning. If you take a look at people's retirement today, you know, 40, 50 years ago, it was pretty straightforward. You went to work for a company. Maybe you worked for the same company for 30 years. The job market was more stable. Technology wasn't traveling at the speed it is today. And when you retired, you got 80 to 90% of your, let's say, salary and a pension, plus you got Social Security. It was pretty straightforward. You take a look at the last three or four decades. The average person may have three or four jobs before they retire. And instead of that defined benefit plan that guaranteed you a certain level of income, the only thing you have is what you put away in your own retirement plan, whether it was a 401k, profit sharing plan, or if you get Social Security. And who would have thought in the last 13 years, we would see two bear markets that saw the stock market lose anywhere from 40 to 50%. You remember the 1990s, the new economy when technology was going to take us into prosperity? the NASDAQ lost 70% of its value in the first bear market of the new century. And who would have ever thought, decade after decade, that homes would go down in value? So retirement planning is more complex today. Incomes haven't kept up, there's inflation, and there are a lot of things. And this brings me up to a story that was in the weekend edition of Barron's, and it was called Global Payouts Hit $1 Trillion. This was on March 1st. It's Shirley Lazo. She does a story each week in Barron's on dividend increases. And here's the thing. Dividends paid by the world's listed companies burst through $1 trillion mark for the first time in history in 2013. It was a gain of $310 billion, an increase of 43% since 2009. Now, a lot of these companies you're going to be familiar with, and they're some of the largest companies on the planet. In fact, these big, large blue chip companies that we so often talk about, think of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and there's a similar average in Europe. It's called the Dow Jones Euro Stock Index. It's about 50 stocks. One out of every $10 of global income came from a small group of stocks, 10 companies. Think of Royal Dutch, dividend yield of close to 5%. Think of ExxonMobil. Warren Buffett just bought 40 million shares, almost 3% yield. Think of Apple, China Construction, HSBC Holdings, a foreign company, China Mobile, Vodafone, AT&T, Banco Santander, and General Electric, one of the few original companies of the Dow Jones Industrial Average that was put together in the 19th century. So dividends have been increasing year after year, despite the financial crisis, despite the European crisis, the pig country crisis. Year after year, companies have been increasing their income to shareholders, and that level has now approached $1 trillion and still growing.
While we're thinking about this whole idea of income sources, Jim, I know we often get a lot of questions here about, you know, investing internationally and if that's a good idea or not, and do we invest internationally and what types of companies are we looking at? We're looking at emerging market companies or what have you. And our response to that question really has been is that, you know, we're not so much focused on where the company is domiciled. We're more interested in where its revenues are coming from. And I think that this is an interesting tie-in to this idea of dividends, Jim, because one of the questions is, if you're looking for dividend income, is it better to go to an emerging markets focused company or to a company that's getting most of its revenue stream from, let's say, America, from the US or from Europe, for example? And in her article, Ms. Lazo was talking about how payouts from companies in emerging markets doubled, more than doubled between 2009 and 2011. And they did stall later on when currencies had a problem against the US dollar. But right now, she states a statistic I find really interesting. She says that emerging markets now make up $1 of every $7 of global distributions, with some of the biggest gains coming from the Asia-Pacific region, for example, even Japan being up 29% over that period. I think this is really interesting, Jim, because it sort of goes to the idea of saying that, you know, there's life in the old dog yet. In other words, it's too soon to throw off the U.S. as a source of dividend payers and certainly too soon to throw off Europe as a source of dividend paying income, that there's still a reason to be invested in some of these established world economies, despite the focus we've had over the past several years on, you know, investing in emerging markets and focusing on emerging markets. There's still strong reason, especially for dividend paying, to be invested in companies that are domiciled or have income streams coming from the U.S. or Europe.
Yeah, and sometimes, folks, you're thinking about, well, it's good to be diversified internationally. Many of you may not realize, you take a look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average of 30 stocks. Most of the companies in the Dow Jones Industrial Average get a bulk of their sales or almost half of their sales overseas. So you may think of Coca-Cola as a southern domestic U.S. company, but Coke gets 70% of its revenues from around the world. So you can get diversification by owning a domestic company that has something that you can understand, you can follow in the papers, follow on your computer each day, you know exactly what the price is. So what we want to do now is put together how dividends play a role in retirement, because whether you're going to American College reading the papers by Wade Pfau or Professor Fenke today that I'll be talking to here in just a moment, they're all talking about the cost of living that occurs in retirement. And let me just kind of put that cost of living in perspective. When you first retire, you're probably thinking, okay, it's a chance to do things you've never done before or didn't have the time to do. If you play golf, well, gosh, being retired, you're going to improve your golf game because you're going to be able to play 3 or 4 times a week. Or what about those vacations you thought about taking, you never had the time? Wouldn't it be nice to go to Europe for 3 weeks instead of a week when you only have a couple weeks vacation? So you start spending money on things that you've sort of postponed because you didn't have the time. So in your early years in retirement, your health is good, you're spending money, maybe you take up a hobby, maybe you take up golf, maybe you take up painting, whatever that recreation is, you take it up, so you're spending money on things that you didn't spend before, or more on things that you didn't spend before. Maybe you're taking more trips. Now, in your early years of retirement, that's what you're doing. As you get older, what we have found historically, especially when you get in your upper 70s and 80s, you're not doing as much traveling. You may have more health issues, but here's the thing that hits you when you get into the upper 70s and 80s. Now you're spending more money on health issues. You may end up, one spouse has to get put into a long-term care facility, and you're picking up part of that cost. So what these retirement planning specialists are saying is you better have a source of increasing income in those later years, or you could find yourself in trouble spending down your principal. And I'll tell you where I see this trouble surface. And it usually happens when both spouses are living. And one spouse becomes seriously ill, dementia, Alzheimer's, and all of a sudden now, you have two household expenses. You have the expenses of the well spouse who is living in the existing home, and then the one that is sick or needs constant care may be in a long-term care facility. Now you have two expenses you have to pay for. So in the early years, you may be spending money on a lot of discretionary things like travel, golf, or hobbies. In the latter years, you're spending it on things that, well, you hope you don't have to spend, and that's poor health. So what I wanted to do, we put together this hypothetical couple in retirement, and it's based on 30 years of retirement, the things that we've seen. And let's just call them John and Sally. John is 66, both of them are retired, they're moving to a new place, they have a new country club, now they're taking up golf seriously now that they're retired. Their basic needs are about $70,000 a year, and their wants, from travel to vacations to country club membership, all the things that they want to do now that they're retired, are $30,000 a year. So for simplification, we're making their expenses $100,000. $70,000 of basic needs, $30,000 of I want needs. Now, that may sound high, but let me tell you, if you live in New York, you live in places like Boston, you live in California, where, you know, our definition of a millionaire is a homeowner, maybe not so much after the financial crisis, but their basic needs were $100,000. Now, what we did is we took that $100,000 and we used two inflation rates. We used a 2% inflation rate, and we used a 3% inflation rate. But I think you're going to get the picture here when I talk about your expenses going up, and you're going to relate to this because you've seen your budget over the years. Can you think of anything that maybe other than going to Costco and buying a plasma or an LED TV that's gone down, or computers have gone down, but your cost of living hasn't? Now, with a 2% inflation rate, that $100,000 goes to $110,000 in 5 years. In 20 years, it goes to $121,000. And here's the difficult one, folks. And this is where I've seen this happen so many times. It hits so many retirees in their latter years, in their 70s and their 80s, when medical expenses go up. At a 2% inflation rate, 20 years from now, that $100,000 budget will require almost $149,000. You take a 3% inflation rate, the numbers become even more staggering. In 10 years, with the 3% inflation rate, that $100,000, you're going to need $134,000 to buy the same goods and services. And here's a shocker. A 3% inflation rate doesn't sound like much, but in 20 years, you're going to need over $180,000. That's a lot of money any way you look at it.
Well, Jim, I think this is kind of a little difficult for people to process because I'm sure that they're thinking, you know, I'm really having a hard time imagining meeting my retirement expenses now, much less with inflation calculated in. What in the world do I do to counteract the effects of inflation on my cost of living? And, you know, there's a number of ways to do that. If you're someone who's in retirement and you're looking to have an income stream that's somehow keeping up with inflation, we already mentioned that Social Security is indexed to government inflation rates. You can also invest in individual bonds that are inflation indexed. That's one way of counteracting inflation's effects on your income stream. There are annuities that offer cost of living adjustment riders. So if you're someone that's worried about your income stream needing to increase year over year, there are annuity products you can purchase that will offer you a fixed increase in your income every year at a pre-agreed upon rate. Now, of course, Jim and I are going to focus on this last idea, which is investments in companies that have a history of not only paying dividends, but increasing their dividends year over year to their investors. Now, again, kind of like Jim's discussion of inflation figures a few minutes ago, a small increase in the amount of dividend paid out year over year may not seem like a whole lot, but you start compiling that year after year after year, and pretty soon that increase rate really starts to have a dramatic impact on the income coming into your portfolio. So let's just go ahead and use a sample 2.8% dividend yield on a portfolio and a 10% year-over-year dividend growth rate. Now, this is pretty similar to the Kohl's. I don't know if many of you shop at Kohl's, sort of a similar situation to JCPenney's, for example, basically a store that sells clothing for folks. And in her article, this is something that Ms. Lazo quotes as having a 2.8% dividend yield. And in this article, the Kohl's year-over-year growth rate is more like 11.4%. But just to make this a little easier, for example, we're going to use an initial dividend rate of 2.8% and a 10% year-over-year dividend growth rate. Now, again, may not seem like a whole lot to have this dividend rate increase 10% year-over-year. But after 5 years at that increase rate year-over-year in the dividend stream, your dividend rate in 5 years is going to be 4.51%. In 10 years, 7.26%. Now hold on, because in 20 years, at that growth rate, your initial 2.8% dividend stream is going to be an 18.84% dividend stream. Wow, that's pretty impressive. Let's actually look at this in terms of dollars and cents. Let's just say that you had 100,000 shares of a company that was paying you 25 cents a share, and that 25 cents a share dividend yield was increasing 10% year over year. In 5 years, your dividend payout would be 40 cents a share. In 10 years, 65 cents a share. And in 20 years, $1.68 per share. For 100,000 shares, that would be $168,000 worth of income in 20 years from those same $100,000 shares. So you can sort of see that over time, again, these small incremental increases in the dividend payout stream can have a pretty dramatic impact on your overall income stream.
And Kathleen, that example of 2.8%, let me give you a real example of one of the world's most successful investors, Warren Buffett. Now, in the fourth quarter of last year, Berkshire Hathaway, Warren's company, disclosed that they took a position in ExxonMobil. Warren spent $3 billion or bought 40 million shares of ExxonMobil. Now, I've talked about this example on the weekend program a lot, but why would Warren do something like that? Well, insurance companies normally invest in bonds. What Warren was looking at was ExxonMobil as a bond with increasing income, because when Warren was buying Exxon, the yield on a 10-year treasury note was 2.8%. But what Warren knew is that 2.8% dividend yield on Exxon, which has been increasing its dividend at over 10% a year, in 10 years from now, his yield on his original investment would be 7.26% versus the 2.8% yield that he would have if he kept his money in bonds. And so what Warren was doing was he was looking at Exxon. Why did he feel comfortable that his yield 10 years from now would be higher than what it would be if he bought, let's say, a treasury bond? Well, number one, ExxonMobil has a moat, a protective moat. It's very expensive to get in the oil business. Number two, ExxonMobil has been around for more than half a century. It was a part of the original Standard Oil Trust. Actually, you can say it's been around for over a century. And more importantly, it has a high return on equity and a history of increasing dividends year after year after year. Same thing with companies like Coca-Cola, another company that Warren owns. Do you know that Warren is making over 100% yield on his original investment in Coca-Cola? And this gets back to the illustration that Kathleen just mentioned. If you start out with a company that's paying 25 cents a year in dividends, and it's growing that dividend at 10%, you know what? That dividend goes from 25 cents to $1.68 in 20 years. And this is the thing that you want. 5 years from now, 10 years from now, or even 20 years from now in retirement, you need to ask yourself, in those latter years where you're probably not thinking about that right now, but when you get into your 70s or in your 80s, when you think about those increased health costs that you're going to have to absorb, and especially now with Obamacare, where more of those costs are being shifted over to private individuals, where's that money going to come from? Well, you have enough assets. And your income stream, will your Social Security be able to take care of that? Your fixed pension, is that going to take care of that? If you have money in the bank, will that increase in value in dividends in the next 5-10 years? So what I want to do is I want to give you a hypothetical example, because we're taking a look at yields today, and we took a portfolio of $3.6 million. And what we did is we said, typically what most people do is say you're age 65. This is the standard quote you get in these pie charts that I think really don't apply in a lot of retirement planning. But what we did is we took the standard pie chart for somebody age 65. It would be 65% in bonds and 35% in stocks. Now, what that would do is in bonds, the yield was 2.8%. We did something very safe. We did treasuries. And then we did stocks. And remarkably, you can find stocks that are paying more than bonds, probably the first time in my career and probably the first time in 50 years. Now, originally, that would produce roughly about $100,000 a year in income. About $65,000 would come from interest on bonds, and the other $35,000 would come from stocks. Now, here's what happens over time. In 5 years, the bond income would still be $65,000. In 10 years, the bond income would be $65,000, and assuming interest rates remain constant, in 20 years, it would be $65,000. Now, watch what happens with dividends that increase 10%. In 5 years, the $35,000 in dividends would be almost $57,000. In 10 years, the dividends would be $92,000, surpassing the interest earned on the 65% of the portfolio that was invested in bonds. In 20 years, the dividends would be $237,000. So instead of $100,000 income, the income in 20 years would be $300,000. That is how you keep up with inflation. And now what we did is we took a look at some of the studies that were done on retirement planning from the American College with Wayne Pfau and my guest today. We reversed it. And we said, what if we put 35% in bonds and 65% in stocks? Brace yourself when I tell you what the numbers are. First of all, we start out in year one with $100,000. But remember, of that $100,000, $35,000 came from bonds, $65,000 came from stocks. In 5 years from now, the income would be $105,000 from stocks, $35,000 from bonds, for a total income of $140,000. 10 years from now, the dividend income would be $170,000 alone just from stocks and the $35,000 from bonds, which are fixed, for an income of $205,000. 20 years from now, the income from dividends would be $441,000 for an income of almost $500,000. And it's why you're seeing today that a lot of the assumptions that were made, let's say the last two or three decades, at least when I got in the business and I became a certified financial planner in 1980, bonds back then when I got in the business were paying 15%. I can remember getting 12%, 13%, 14% on Ginnie Mae's, 9% on municipal bonds. And so bonds became ingrained as part of the retirement portfolio. You fast forward now 30 years later, and here's one that'll throw you off. Do you realize that over 50% of the companies in the S&P 500 pay a dividend yield higher than what you could get in a 5-year treasury note? In fact, folks, if you went back 5 years ago, I could have got 5% on a 2-year treasury note. Today, I'm lucky if I get a quarter of 1% on a 2-year treasury note. So times have changed, but one thing that hasn't changed is the cost of living has gone up for most Americans year after year. And you've heard the statistics. They've been written about in the major papers. They've been talked about on the evening news. Americans are falling further behind. Their incomes aren't keeping up with inflation. Their costs are going up. The Fed is printing money. And for the first time, the Fed has a policy of creating inflation. Their goal is they want to see 2% inflation. And if you listen to the Premium Channel, I interviewed recently a very prominent investment strategist, Dave Rosenberg. He used to be the chief investment strategist at Merrill Lynch. He's now at Gluskin Schiff. And Dave was a prominent deflationist. And during the course of that interview, I asked him, I said, Dave, you've now moved over into the inflation camp. What caused you to change those views? Because you were one of the most prominent deflationists out there that I've known. He said, Jim, when the Fed announced QE2, back in the fall of 2010, when I read the minutes accompanying that meeting, they said they were targeting 2% inflation. So I know that the largest central bank in the world adopts its policy of inflation. They will get inflation. And that's one thing I could probably assure you. And, well, I don't have to tell you much because you can just look at where you're spending your money. Are you paying less for gas today and your groceries than you did 5 years ago or 10 years ago? Are your utility bills coming down? Are your medical bills coming down? Your medical premiums, your utilities, everything that you spend money on, can you think of anything that's really going down? It's going up. So you have to ask yourself, if you're retired 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, how are you going to keep up with the cost of living?
Jim, you know, I was just looking at the bond income rates on our couple of examples we just talked about, and it just strikes me one more time that the pro and the con of fixed income or bonds is that it's fixed. It's dependable, it's steady, but it's dependable and it's steady and it doesn't grow. So the fact that it's fixed is both a pro and a con for bond income. And again, I don't want to have people listening think that there's no place for bonds in a portfolio. There is. There are certain situations and circumstances in which having a laddered bond portfolio makes a lot of sense, or at least a portion of the portfolio allocated to laddered bonds can make a lot of sense. On the other hand, neither are Jim and I saying that having your entire portfolio dedicated to dividend paying stocks is necessarily the answer either. There's always a risk of loss with stocks, and certainly each investor has a different age, risk tolerance, financial situation, income requirement, etc. So what we are saying, though, is that if you're worried about inflation's impact on your income stream, it might be time to meet with your own financial advisor and see if it's time to think about allocating a portion of your portfolio to dividend-paying stocks. Just something to think about if you're concerned about inflation's impact on your income stream in your retirement years.
Now we're going to move on to an interview that I did. And once again, one of the things that has surprised me recently is more and more colleges in their, let's say, investment or financial departments are now including a specialty getting professors on retirement planning. I think one of the reasons, as I talked about as we began Lifetime Income this week, is the retirement today is so much different than when I got in the business. I mean, when I got in the business in 1980, most people had defined benefit pension plans. They got 80 to 90% of their salary in a pension. Their medical costs were covered, Social Security. Between the two, most people were living well. That isn't the world we live in today. Most boomers have had 4 or 5 jobs. Most companies have got rid of their defined benefit pension plans. And all you have is what you've put aside in your savings and retirement plan. Not to mention the fact that raising a family the last 30 years, you've seen education costs go up at 8% a year. So you have to think about retirement much differently today. Throw aside those old rules, because one of the things that you'll find that's coming out in retirement study after retirement study, those old rules, those cookie cutter plans, those pie charts that we used for decade after decade don't apply in the current age that we live in, where interest rates are at zero, where central banks are pursuing policies of inflation, and wages are no longer keeping up with inflation, although the cost of living keeps going up. So there's a lot of new retirement income theories that are asking retirees to consider a 3-pronged approach to their retirement, which includes annuities if they need it for a dependable income, individual bonds, and dividend-paying stocks. There is no one perfect investment here, folks. And certainly, the suggested allocation to stocks is higher now than in the past. And the reason you're seeing these universities come out with this is for the first time in a half a century, a lot of stocks are paying yields that are much higher than bonds. So coming up, Dr. Michael Finke, professor and director of retirement planning and living at Texas Tech, about these retirement income planning and happiness planning ideas, coming up right after this. Well, you worked all your life and you dreamed about it. Yes, retirement. But what is retirement like today? Certainly, people are working longer and people are living longer. So the retirement we used to think about no longer looks the same. Joining me on the program is Professor Michael Finke. He's at the Texas Tech University. He's professor and director of retirement planning and living. You know, Professor, in your article, you talk about there's two basic theories of retirement living. The first is the continuity theory, and then there's the activity theory. For our listeners who may not be familiar with those terms, explain.
Well, continuity theory says that you're going to be better off if you essentially keep many of the same facets of your pre-retirement life. That is, that essentially the only difference becomes that you're not going to work anymore, that you live in the same home, that you keep the same friends, that you maintain your daily routine. And the evidence does not seem kind to that hypothesis. It does seem that oftentimes people will get into patterns of habit that your life may essentially look like your old life, except you do not get a lot of the stimulation that you would in a work environment. And in fact, one of the most consistent predictors other than health of happiness in retirement is how frequently you interact with other people. And if you quit your job, then you also quit that regular interaction. And oftentimes when we come home, we are accustomed to a lifestyle that doesn't necessarily involve interaction with a lot of other people. So activity theory says that you should essentially start a new lifestyle after you retire, that you should think about interacting with a different group of people, that you should put yourself in a different environment that's more conducive to retirement happiness. And that seems to be the best route for most retirees. That there can be a lot of temptation because of inertia not to build a new lifestyle, but you're probably better off thinking about how to build a lifestyle that's going to make you the happiest in retirement and starting anew in a completely different direction.
What about, Professor, you're in a situation that when you were, let's say, working, what about having avocations, hobbies, sports? I mean, I know a lot of people play golf. They think of travel when it comes to retirement. I mean, if you play golf, it's 4 hours. So obviously, if you're working during the week, you don't have the time. So that's one activity you can carry over. But you're talking about things that are more stimulating, I believe.
That's right. In terms of playing golf, we all have this idea of what we're going to do when we retire. And it basically looks a lot like how we spend our leisure time before retirement. But I think sometimes we forget that we're going to have to fill an extra 40 hours a week, plus the time that we spend commuting to work, plus any work that we do on the weekends. And it's not really possible to reproduce the same type of mental stimulation from engaging in those kinds of leisure activities, which we may have enjoyed mainly because they weren't that stimulating, because they were relaxing. So how do you build a new lifestyle that maintains a certain amount of mental stimulation that's different than the way you engaged in leisure before? And that's why doing things like building a hobby and building a set of acquaintances that you can maintain in retirement is maybe even more important than having enough money at retirement.
You know, one thing that you talk about that's very important, I mean, everybody wants to arrive at retirement with enough assets, income, et cetera, that makes that retirement sustainable. But you also talk about something that is very important, and that's investing in health, diet. Because as we get older, if you've had a very stressful lifestyle, maybe you're a little bit overweight, we know that eventually we start developing problems the older we get. So let's talk about investing in health, which is almost as important as learning how to invest in one's portfolio.
That's right. I mean, if you think about this as a stage in your life where you have control over how physically able you are to do things that you enjoy. And you also have a little bit of control over how long your retirement is going to be. We know that, for example, people who have more wealth tend to live longer, and they tend to be more active in retirement. And I think one of the reasons is because there is a correlation between saving money for retirement, financial investments, and also thinking about maintaining your physical health. So that can be as important to being able to get the most out of, for example, your leisure time in retirement as saving up money. You know, it's difficult to buy happiness in retirement if you're not physically able to enjoy going on trips or traveling or engaging in other types of leisure activities like golf or sailing, if you don't have the physical ability to do it.
There's something also that I've seen in this business is different stages of retirement. Initially, I've seen a lot of clients that will retire and they'll say, you know, we never got to take that long trip to Europe, or we never got to visit places because we were either working, taking care of the kids. And then also as you get into the later stages of your life where maybe disabilities come in, disease or ailments come in, let's talk about retirement stages, because there are retirement stages. Obviously, when you first retire, what you're going to be doing may look different than, let's say, 20 years into retirement. And also talk about the idea, Professor, that one can spend, depending on one's health and when you retire, between both spouses, maybe 20, 25 years in retirement.
Yeah, that's right. The old way of thinking is that there is this go-go period that maybe lasts 10 to 15 years in retirement, a slow-go period that begins in your late 70s. 80 seems to be a big dividing line when it comes to physical and mental abilities. There does seem to be a stage that occurs in the 80s where you do start to slow down, and that actually shows up in spending data. There appears to be something that looks like a spending smile in retirement. You tend to spend more money at the beginning. As you get deeper into retirement, you end up spending less, but then when you have greater health expenses later in life, that's when spending starts going up. And especially in the United States, where people have to cover a lot of those long-term care expenses, a lot of wealth can be used later on in life to cover those types of expenses. But I think one of the most important things to realize is that we are mortals and that we are going to decline in retirement. We can maintain our physical abilities and to some extent our mental abilities, but we are going to inevitably experience some of that decline. And one of the things we need to do is start planning on how we will live in that later stage of retirement. And one of the best things I think we can do early on in retirement is think about how to set ourselves, first of all, in a living situation where we don't have to do quite as much work. Maybe we're going to plan on, at the age of 80 or 85, moving out of our homes and into a different type of living environment. It's much easier to do when you plan ahead, because oftentimes when we get to that stage, we don't feel like we're quite ready to do that yet, when in fact it would be helpful to be able to move into an easier type of living environment, and the type of living environment where we're more likely to interact with other people. The other thing is cognitive decline, that when it comes to managing our own investments, it's probably best not to have to take on a lot of complex financial decision making when we make it into our 80s. We can either have an advisor or buy an annuity type product later in life that allows us to simply draw an income without the potential of making investment mistakes.
Yeah, I want to come back to this lifestyle change. Let's say that you spent your entire life, you're an engineer or you're a businessman. What you've shown in your studies, when you retire, if you create a new retirement lifestyle, maybe new interest. I remember one of my clients who retired had a very, very busy life, and they moved from the Midwest to Southern California, actually gravitated up towards Northern California, and he ended up being a tour guide at the Hearst Castle. He just absolutely loved it, loved meeting people from around the world that came to see the place, but his lifestyle and what he did was totally divorced from what he did prior to retirement.
And I think that that is a terrific idea. And I think oftentimes we tend to see lower paying work in retirement as something that's beneath us. But I think if you accept this as a new lifestyle, as something completely different, then I think you can make much more rational decisions about how to spend time in retirement. And, you know, what's interesting is the people who have bought into it seem to be a lot happier. And the people who try to maintain their old life and even their old professional life don't seem to be as happy unless they really loved what they did. If it was just a matter of making money, then if you continue to consult, for example, in old age, oftentimes that leads to less happiness than if you start doing something new that's better suited to what you want to get out of retirement. And there's nothing wrong with taking a job that gives you that social interaction that is essentially more fun than playing golf. I mean, a lot of people think of having to work instead of playing golf all day long as a sacrifice that you make in retirement. But it all depends on the individual. If you're somebody that likes that constant mental challenge, and what we also find is that some type of mental challenge does lead to greater happiness, but too much mental challenge is not good. And this is why doing something like becoming a tour guide is a perfect kind of retirement activity, because it does maintain that mental challenge, but it's not too much. It's not too much stress.
Yeah, he not only liked finding out more about the castle, and he obviously got to see a lot of parts that they don't show the public, so he got a lot into the history. And then also, but I think what he liked most is something you describe, is interacting with other people, because people from all around the globe come vacation to California, and that's one of the sites that people visit. And I think he just absolutely loved the interaction he had with tourists from around the world and around the country.
And I think that that takes a certain amount of wisdom in retirement to be able to understand what it is that is really going to make you happy during those years. We see on the commercials people taking walks on the beach and playing golf, but that may not be everybody's cup of tea. It may not be what makes us the happiest. And being willing to be a little bit creative to think about opportunities that we normally wouldn't associate with a happy retirement is really how I hope we get a chance to redefine what retirement is all about in the future. It's accepting that we're changing as human beings, and then we're trying to get the most out of that life stage.
I want to move on to some of the financial factors. Certainly there is a confluence of different factors that go into making one financially secure. You know, some people are fortunate, especially if you're in government where you have a defined benefit pension plan that is somewhat predictable. More wealth leads to greater happiness in retirement. Obviously, you're not stressed. You can do things that you'd like to do. But in your studies, you found that the relationship actually starts to decline at higher levels of wealth. Explain that.
Well, one of the things that people do when they have a lot of non-annuitized wealth, and I should say from the start that how people frame an income, like a pension income in retirement, versus how they frame money that's in a 401k or an IRA in retirement is very different. If we get a check this month for $5,000 from our pension, we feel no barrier to spending that money on something fun. You know, maybe we can go on a cruise, or maybe we can buy something special for ourselves. But if we have to spend that $5,000 out of our IRA, we feel like we're doing something wrong. People are much more resistant to spending money out of a stock like that. And that's one of the reasons why thinking about annuitizing part of your wealth seems to make a lot of sense. We're really just in the beginning of this defined contribution era, and we're beginning to understand how best to manage retirement spending using our defined contribution savings. And it seems that at least annuitizing a portion of it or turning it into a pension can actually make people feel like they have license to spend that money. And one of the most interesting things that we see is that people who have a lot of money tend to die with even more at the end of retirement. So they don't end up spending a lot of that money. In fact, money can become something of a burden. You have to manage all that money. You've got tax issues. You may have relatives that want access to that money. And it seems that there's an inflection point at about $2.5 million in retirement, that if people tend to oversave, because they don't spend that money, the money essentially becomes a burden. It is, in a way, kind of like an insurance policy against a major expense. But chances are that that money is not doing you any good if you don't feel as if you have license to spend it, and if it's becoming more of a hindrance than a help.
You know, one thing that's somewhat contradictory, we talked about earlier in our discussion, when you retire, to invest in health, diet, exercise, things that are going to make you healthier, make you more active. And obviously, you know, if you spend the time to get healthy, it also increases your lifespan. So that also creates a problem, too, because I remember when they first put Social Security into place, men were expected to retire at 62, 63, live 3 or 4 years in retirement and die. Well, now we have people in their 80s. We have people in their 90s. I have clients in mid-90s, and one just passed away, just not quite short of 100. So if you do all these things to keep yourself healthy and active, your mind, stimulating your mind, keeping that healthy as well, that also means that your money is going to have to last over a longer period of time.
That's right. And one of the things that I think we need to think more about and that clients need to think more about is, when is the right age of retirement? Because if you're thinking that 60 is the right age of retirement, then you really have, on average, a 25-year time horizon, especially in a low-yield environment. It's very difficult to fund a 20-year retired life with maybe a 35-year working life. So I think we're going to need to be a lot more reasonable about when we decide to retire. We do get a bump in our annuitized Social Security income if we're able to delay it. For most couples, delaying till age 70 makes a lot of sense. I think that being reasonable about how well we want to live in retirement and understanding that if we want to retire earlier, we're going to have to live a little bit more modestly. And is that the type of trade-off that we want to make? And for some people, it may be worth it. For others, it may not. But you're absolutely right. When you make that investment in health, not only do you get more out of your retirement years, but you do have a longer retirement. So that does increase the risk that you're going to run out of money. But it also points to the importance of having some sort of annuitized income source, whether it be a higher Social Security payment or some type of immediate or deferred annuity product.
So if one is considering, let's say our listeners are listening to this program, maybe they're 5 years away from retirement, when does one take a look at that or try to imagine what retirement is like? And Professor, for some individuals, they don't have the time. During the financial downturn, a lot of people were retired prematurely. They got laid off and they were at that point in life where they're now in retirement. So give us a picture of planning a successful retirement. What might the steps be to reaching that goal?
You know, I think that a lot of people have difficulty with leisure. I think a lot of people who are workaholics or who enjoy their job a lot need to think reasonably about how much happier they're going to be in this different lifestyle and to be able to see it as a different lifestyle. And that also takes a little bit of an investment in terms of figuring out where you want to live, what kind of a lifestyle you want to have, making some investments in establishing relationships or building hobbies prior to retirement so that you can get a better idea of what is going to consume your time in retirement. But I think a lot of people stop working without thinking about how they're going to spend their time after they stop working. And just like making a financial investment, it's worth making a little bit of an investment to imagine what your lifestyle is going to be like in retirement. That may mean traveling places, looking at places to live, taking vacations in places that you are thinking of retiring, and simulating that type of lifestyle to see how happy you might be if you had it. There's a great example of one of our professors here, Harold Levinsky, tells about one of his clients who decided that he wanted to buy a recreational vehicle at retirement. He wanted to drive around the country. And he was going to pay, you know, maybe $300,000 for the RV. And so Harold said, why don't you just rent it for a year? I know it's expensive, but lease it and see if that's the lifestyle that you want, knowing that based on his client's personality, they might get sick of it after a year. And apparently after a couple of months, he was already sick of that lifestyle. You know, and that's an example of how a lifestyle that seemed very appealing when you were working may not seem as appealing when you're not working, when you don't have that continued mental stimulation that you want to be able to step away from. Perhaps a happier retirement is one where you're not always traveling.
You know, it's interesting because I had a client with a similar story, was thinking, you know, getting in a motorhome, traveling across the country. They took a look at the cost of the motorhome, and we were looking at where the money was going to come from. They wanted to pay cash for it, so we were going to have to take a substantial amount of money to do it. And then I told them something my in-laws did, where they just took a car, drove across the country, and stayed in hotels. It was actually much cheaper.
And that's the kind of suggestion I think that if you're an advisor, it makes some sense to dip your toe in the lifestyle before you go all in, whether it be even buying a vacation home or some other big purchase that's going to lock you into a certain type of retirement lifestyle. Make sure that you're going to like it first.
Great idea. Well, listen, Professor, great article. You hit upon some things that I think a lot of people don't think about in retirement. They think about, okay, how much money am I going to have? Will I be able to live and afford what I like doing? But really what you're talking about is a completely different life, a new lifestyle, new friendships, new activities, focusing really on your health and diet, and then also on the interconnectivity that you have with people that you had when you once worked. Great article, by the way, and I want to thank you for joining us on the Financial Sense News Hour.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, that concludes this week's Lifetime Income. I hope you picked up on some of the things that we discussed there with the professor, because many times on this show, we talk about many things. We talk about finances. We talk about estate planning. We also talk about health issues. But remember, the healthier that you become, the longer that you live, the longer that money's going to have to last. And there's so many things that you can do to make your retirement more meaningful, enjoyable. I told the story of one of my clients, a very busy, active individual, and ended up in retirement. Didn't start out thinking about this, but moved towards Midway in California, closer to San Luis Obispo, and visited Hearst Castle. And I don't know how it came about, but ended up being a tour guide there. And it was just delightful for him. He loved learning about the castle, the Hearst family, the things that they did, the history behind it, but more importantly, the interaction he had with people from around the world. Well, that concludes this week's program. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for joining us here. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.